kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From the Toronto International Film Festival, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Ballgame, Matty Robinson. On this week's show, 2 men, 5 days, 40 movies. We'll share our top 5 favorite movies from this year's festival.
Plus, Massacre Theater, music by Arcade Fire, and an interview with filmmaker Guy Madden, whose movie My Winnipeg premiered here in Toronto. We'll also spend a few minutes discussing the new documentary The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters.
But first, it's fitting, Adam, that we start off this week by tackling the latest effort from Toronto's native son, David Cronenberg.
She died on my shift.
I thought you did birth.
Sometimes birth and death go together. She came in with needle punches all over both arms. Probably a prostitute, the age of 14. Do you think Semyon's son knew her?
I am driver. I go left, I go right, I go straight ahead, that's it.
Adam, we get so much feedback here at Film Spotting. It's wonderful how our audience writes in.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to go to the Film Spotting email mailbox this morning.
Yes.
And pulled this one off. Okay. I don't think you saw it yet.
No, I haven't.
Because actually it was addressed to you. I hope it's okay.
Okay, go ahead. Let's run with it.
Dear Mr. Kempinar, I received your fan mail. Thank you for your kind words. Your Cronenberg Nation t-shirt and Dead Zone decoder ring are in the mail. I must say, I'm a big fan of yours as well. I just got finished listening to your review of My History of Violence, which you ranked as the top film of 2005, calling it a gruesome modern-day fairy tale. You were right on.
I sound smart.
Yeah, you really got it. Unlike that misinformed but strikingly handsome co-host, Matty Ballgame. I'm curious to hear, Mr. Kempinar, then, what you'll make of my recent film. It does star History of Violence's Viggo Mortensen as a driver for the Barconi Russian Mafia in London, and your favorite actress, Naomi Watts, as a doctor protecting a newborn baby against the clutches of Armin Mueller Stahl's Russian mob boss. Let me know, Mr. Kempinar, if my success continues, or am I a tad out of my element on the streets of London? Yours, big fan, DC.
Yeah, somehow I'm guessing you maybe had a hand in writing that, but it'd be nice if David Cronenberg really did listen to the show. I am a fan of his work, and really I'm a fan because of his last film. I've liked other David Cronenberg films, but A History of Violence was my favorite film, as you just mentioned, of 2005, and really kind of put Cronenberg back on the map for me and made me love his work again, and made me really excited about this film, Eastern Promises, and I don't think it's as good as A History of Violence. I wouldn't put it up there, and it may not even make my top 5 of the festival, but I did really like the film. And to answer your question, Maddie, about whether or not he's out of his element, I don't think there's any question that he's right in the heart of his element. This film is a David Cronenberg movie in every way. I don't think that stylistically it's as interesting as A History of Violence, which really adapting this kind of graphic novel took some interesting chances and was really challenging, I think, in the way it confronted its audience. I don't think this is nearly as challenging stylistically, the way he uses the camera or any of the editing. I think it's much more conventional in that way. Maybe that's why I find it not as interesting. But in terms of the themes and the story, this is the essence of Cronenberg. And you've got this whole gruesome aspect of it, which, you know, Cronenberg likes to splatter blood from time to time. We've seen that in a lot of his movies, but I don't know how else to phrase it other than to steal a line from Joker in Full Metal Jacket. He makes movies about the duality of man, about conflicted nature, about what defines you as an individual, what or who defines you, those competing forces tugging at you. And we've got a case here, just as we did in History of Violence, with Viggo Mortensen's character, Nikolai. He's this henchman in the Russian mob who has aspirations of rising up the ladder there. We don't know what kind of person he really is, just as we don't know who the real Tom Stahl is in A History of Violence. There's essentially split personalities, and you see here again this dark side to Nikolai, as I said, where he wants to move up the crime ranks and seems very capable of doing a lot of damage and being a very violent, bad man. And yet at the same time, there's something that Naomi Watts, who's a midwife, actually, I believe, here in London, there's something she sees in him that we see in him. We see that conflict. We just don't know what it is. And throughout the entire film, up to a certain point that we can't give away, or I don't want to give away, we don't really know what kind of guy he is. And I think that's the essence of Cronenberg. And I like this movie a lot, just as I liked A History of Violence.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That was articulate.
Thank you.
It was eloquent. It was really well thought through.
And wrong.
And much smarter than this film ever could possibly be.
Oh, come on.
Really, no, honestly, I don't think there is anything authentic in this movie. I think the themes are there, yes, but the execution isn't.
Okay.
I really think this movie is playing at something rather than actually striking an authentic chord. I mean, it's set against the backdrop of this Russian mafia, mm-hmm. but I don't think it actually comes across as knowing what the Russian mafia in London is all about.
Really?
Really, I honestly do. And Viggo Mortensen, I don't think, is given that much to do in this film. Think about it. Think about the screen time that he actually has, mm-hmm. and Naomi Watts and this baby that she's protecting.
Sure.
Far too much screen time is devoted to Armin Mueller-Stahl as this mob boss. And I think a completely incompetent mob boss. Not only is Naomi Watts five steps ahead of him, the audience is five steps ahead of Armin Mueller-Stahl's mob boss.
Hmm.
I think he's completely out of it. I don't think it hits any of the right notes. The pacing is absolutely terrible. It's completely obvious. And rather than a great gangster-like film like The Godfather mm-hmm. that immerses us in this world, I don't think Cronenberg and, unfortunately, the people involved really know this world enough to tell the story.
Well, I think they do. And having read some of the press notes, I think we both saw the press notes. Certainly, yeah. There was a lot of research done, I think, by Cronenberg, by Mortensen, by the screenwriter. I didn't get that sense. I mean, I watched it and felt like I was, even though clearly the movie isn't about the Russian mafia, I felt like I was immersed in their world. And I felt like I understood the language and the iconography of this world and the essence of it. And Armin Mueller-Stahl, I thought, was actually a really interesting character, a ruthless character. And we should say, we haven't really talked about the plot, but
right.
but basically, yeah, it is Naomi Watts as a midwife, and a 14-year-old prostitute comes in and delivers a baby and dies, and the baby ends up staying there, and Naomi Watts becomes really involved in it, and it turns out that there is a link between this baby and the Russian mob, and so then she becomes involved with Viggo Mortensen in a way. And I think the pacing is perfect. I think the pacing is exactly what you would expect from a Cronenberg film, what I like from a film that is deliberately paced, and yet still there are some scenes that are more action-oriented. It's certainly not an action film in any way, but there are some great violent kind of Cronenberg
yes.
scenes, as I mentioned.
Yes, and those ballets of violence that he choreographs, mm-hmm. especially the one in the Russian bath,
yes.
I think is beautifully
it
done.
It is, which my crowd at the press screening I saw actually cheered at the pure audacity of it.
Yeah.
And the final, there's a final little blow. There's a last moment at the end of this, really, as you said, kind of operatic violent scene, and finally everyone just had to cheer because it was so crazy.
Exactly, and I can relish that. And I got excited during that scene. Unfortunately, it's the filler, everything in between. He doesn't know how to manipulate this film with a subtle hand at all. It's so obvious. He just hits you over the head
with
everything.
So.
And think about the dialogue.
It's throughout.
Think about the dialogue, Adam. Remember when when Naomi Watts first goes to the Trans-Siberian Club,
as sure.
if that's the greatest front for a Russian mafia
okay.
you know, overlord.
Yeah.
What's her first line? Or one of her lines? Oh, my father used to make borscht like
that. I know.
That.
Yeah.
I mean, it's terrible. It's terribly saccharine. It just doesn't hit any authentic notes.
Okay. Well, I disagree. I think there is authenticity to it, while at the same time, this air of unnaturality, which comes with Cronenberg. I don't know if that's even the right way to phrase it, but certainly it's there in History of Violence as well. We talked about it a lot back when we reviewed that movie. There is a heightened quality to that film, just as there is with this film. I think there is a certain comic book isn't the way to phrase it, but there is kind of something that just makes these films, Cronenberg's films, not seem natural. That's there. Well, at the same time, I felt like I was enough in that culture that it worked for me. I also think that it's interesting how it is essentially a crime movie. And since this won't be a spoiler edition of the film, I can't get into explaining what I mean here exactly. But there is an aspect to this film that we've seen a million times before in films. And I think that the screenwriter and David Cronenberg as a director find a really interesting way to get around that. And I'm sorry, you talked about the pacing and Viggo Mortensen. All I need to do, and this fits the theme of the movie, is to have time to look at Viggo Mortensen's face and think about what he's thinking about, and that's the whole movie.
Well,
that's the whole movie.
You're going to have a lot of you're going to have a lot of time
you
to
are,
do that in this
and
film.
And that's why I liked it.
Because it just sludges along.
Okay.
This, in all the press notes, this is regarded as a thriller. This has got to be the slowest thriller ever.
I think the way it subverts the genre.
No, I see you use words like subvert.
I like subvert, yes. Yeah, I like movies that subvert.
I think you're giving Mr. Cronenberg far too much credit.
I don't think you're giving him enough credit.
Well, then fine. I think we're just going to have to disagree.
We are going to have to disagree on David Cronenberg, and that's a perfect segue, actually, to our poll question for this week. Of course, if you do get a chance to see Eastern Promises, it's a movie that opens in limited release this weekend. It's slated to expand actually to 1,200 screens next Friday, which kind of surprises me. I don't remember A History of Violence being a huge hit by any means, but giving it a wider release on the 21st. But it's out. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you want to share, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call, 206-203-2463. And leave a voicemail. But let's get on to that poll question then, Maddie. We're trying to gauge Film Spotting listeners, how they feel about David Cronenberg, and we're asking them, which David Cronenberg film is your favorite? The choices are...
All right, and these are the options we came up with. Crash, now that's his film from the 90s. I don't know, not to be confused with the Paul Haggis film.
Of course.
The Dead Zone, The Fly, A History of Violence, Naked Lunch, Other, or... my favorite.
Uh-huh.
He's overrated.
Yeah, I wonder where you're going in this poll
question.
No,
actually, I would go with The Fly. I really enjoy The Fly.
Okay, so you would go with The Fly. I would go with The History of Violence. I really would, of course. But I also am a huge fan of, despite its schlock quality in a way, I am a big fan of The Dead Zone.
Oh,
always
yeah.
will be Christopher Walken in that film. But we want to know what you think. And, of course, you were the one that really wanted to include Crash on there just to see how many people would vote for it. I don't think anyone really considers it one of his top films. But we want to know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard.
All right, time for a quick break, thankfully. When we come back, director Guy Madden tells us how he recreated his most traumatic childhood memories and lived to laugh about it, or at least get really bored. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Ballgame. I'm Adam Kempinar. Last year at the Toronto International Film Festival, director Guy Madden pulled off probably the most audacious event of the fest, maybe in its history, debuting his silent movie Brand Upon the Brain with an ensemble of sound makers, including an 11-piece orchestra. This year, Madden wasn't quite as ambitious, merely unveiling his new film My Winnipeg with a live narrator, Madden himself, an event Maddie, you were lucky enough to get a chance to attend. You actually saw Guy Madden in the flesh delivering his narration for this film.
He was terrific. What a great raconteur.
Yeah. The Globe and Mail called My Winnipeg a hilarious docufantasia from one of Canada's most distinctive directors, which is as good a description as any for a film that mixes archival footage, narration, and even some animation with recreations of Madden's childhood memories growing up in the sleepwalking city.
We sat down with Madden at a mall coffee shop in Toronto and started by asking him where the spark for My Winnipeg came from.
I guess to be kind of smart alecky, started the day I was born in Winnipeg, and then just breathed its atmospheres for half a century, and then kind of decided to, but then most importantly, my bank account emptied out, and I was desperate for some money, and I phoned up this guy Michael Burns, who runs the documentary channel up here in Canada, or he did until he got fired a week ago. And because I'd heard a rumor that he was interested in commissioning a documentary from me, and he said that was true. And he said, "What do you want to do? You can do anything you want." And I said, "I don't know what I want to do. What should I do? I prefer assignments. Because I have actually enjoyed working on assignments in the past." And so he assigned Winnipeg for the simple reason that he'd only been there twice, and both times he'd been thoroughly enchanted. He said, "Don't give me the frozen hellhole we all think Winnipeg is. Enchant me." So basically he assigned me to make a propaganda film about Winnipeg. But I didn't feel I had to. I have a clear conscience because a number of other people who had come to visit me in Winnipeg from far-flung places had come away uttering the same strange things, that they too had been enchanted somehow. So I did set out with an actual documentarian's open mind to try to find out just what it was that was behind these enchantments. And I think I've only begun to scratch the surface of it, but at least I managed to enchant myself, something I'd never done while living there for half a century.
At what point did the personal angle come into it and you knew you wanted to make that part of the story?
That was actually part of the assignment. He said, because I told Michael that I had never intended to make a documentary. I just have far too much respect for documentarians. The amount of research, the amount of disinterestedness they have to have, or should have, it's debatable. But I don't know, even just entering that debate was so paralyzing for me. The amount of awe that I'm held in whenever I think of how a documentary is put together, the amount of discipline, the amount of research, and I've never been a person who wanted to do research or anything, so he said, don't worry about any of this, just make it your Winnipeg, and then the only research you have to do is just some daydreaming about, and just show me your Winnipeg. So there it was.
Following up on the personal aspect of this, I was fortunate enough to see you actually narrate this film on Friday night. How did that come about, first of all? Was that ever your intended?
I think it came about because last year I had a really special event at the Toronto Film Festival, a silent film with Foley artists and a live orchestra and a castrato and a narrator. And when I was talking to Piers Handling, one of the directors of the Toronto Film Festival a few months ago, I told him I had this documentary about Winnipeg. And then I just realized how small that sounded, and so I quickly blurted out, but I'm going to narrate it live, like an old-fashioned travelogue that, you know, those kind of things that used to tour in the 60s.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't mean it, but I just wanted him to be impressed that right. I could maybe somehow turn this into an event. And I think it worked because, whenever there's a live element, it does feel more special. You actually get more audience involvement, whether it's sympathy or a sadistic hope that you'll screw up. Or something. They're just listening a little more, or less likely to walk out because they might think that you can see them leaving, and might actually, change your narration to include the fact that they're leaving or something. So you actually do tend to hold people in their seats a bit more, and it just feels more symbiotic.
Well, I thought your performance was terrific. I thought it was right up there. I was thinking Garrison Keillor, Spalding Gray. There's a future for you.
I can't believe it because I am not a performer. I really didn't. I was cursing the fact that I blurted out this promise that I would perform it. And as soon as I made the promise, I was thinking of the number of actors I could hire with big radio baritones to come on and do the part of me. It wouldn't be beyond me just to have someone pretend to be me. It would be fine.
Right.
I have no moral qualms about that. I've done it many times on and off screen. But Michael Burns once again insisted that it be me. He said it just wouldn't be, it would be too much, it wouldn't be a documentary if it was someone else. So it had to be me.
What came first here, the words or some of the images? Because thinking about the film, it seems like you very much could have constructed it around the script, around your narration, or I can see some of those images in your head and you trying to write to those.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that. I had a number of anecdotes that I either knew, historical stories, anecdotes, legends, that I wrote down and then just started shooting or collecting archival footage for and things like that. But when it came time to editing the film, we were all at an impasse. We didn't know what order to present things in or anything. And in the past, my editor and I had always just used temp music as something to cut to and then either replaced it or just bought the rights to it or used public domain music. And it was simple, but this wasn't a music-driven movie. It was definitely a word-driven movie. So I went into a recording studio and just started talking. Sometimes just the way I'm talking now, conversationally, about Winnipeg. Other times I would prepare something written very quickly, almost Jack Kerouac style. Not as good. I'm not saying I'm as good as Jack Kerouac, but just
moments after I woke up kind of thing, or moments before my appointment in the recording studio. I just write something really quickly, and sometimes I would just leave the, my car running with the lights flashing out front of the recording studio and just go in for 5 minutes and just burst off a few things. And then my editor treated that as temp music, not as, you know, the temp narration. And he would cut it up, sometimes space it out more, rearrange the words. That's why sometimes there's there would have been, before we finally fixed it up, real inconsistencies with verb tenses and grammatical things, because he was literally making a collage out of my narration to make it just the way he would hack up, you know, some Mahler, say, when we're using it as temp music, so that a piece of action happened on a cymbal crash or something like that. So my just this constant stream of babble, like I'm giving you right now, was edited and rearranged like more like music. It just didn't sound so musical. And then picture and word were finally fudged and cut. And then I didn't even re-record much more than a couple sentences, just to sort of smooth out a few inconsistencies. My editor would email me and say, "How about one sentence connecting, you know, horse racing to a restaurant or something?" And I would just have to write a transitional sentence and drop in on the recording studio for 1 minute and record this sentence or two.
We mentioned the personal aspect of it, and one of the great parts of the film, we both think, is the sequence where you reshoot some of the moments from your childhood growing up in Winnipeg. And I think we're both very curious how much of that was just a really great conceit for the film and how much of it was an actual attempt at catharsis.
You know, it's only recently that I discovered that filmmaking is really therapeutic in many ways that I never suspected. I've not once have I worked through any problems and gotten to the root of them or anything, but it's just that filmmaking takes so long. It's at least a year to get a feature out if you're even a fast mover, you know. And you have to watch your own movie so many times, and you have to reread what you've written, and then I don't know. In other words, you end up getting bored of what you were once bored with, what you were once obsessed with. And it's actually just kind of a form of aversion therapy. It's just that you just, instead of being at peace with your childhood traumas because you've, like I say, worked them through, you know, you've just grown tired of your childhood traumas, and they don't traumatize you anymore. Besides, you've turned them into something else, something you're now proud of, and you've turned them into product isn't quite the right word, but an artifact of what you do for a living, and so you end up just using it. And even just getting inside the Winnipeg Arena, which is like the Wrigley Field of Winnipeg, while it was being torn down, which is really traumatizing for me, but being able to videotape it from the inside and being the only person to do so, and being able to relieve myself, being the last man to relieve himself in the men's washroom at the place, sort of helped make its demolition my own somehow, something that I owned, and I could feel kind of special at least. It was like having a really good funeral in the family, it really was a consolation to be able to go in and at least record it forever, and also and pay tribute to it, and so it is kind of therapeutic in strange ways. Going back into your childhood home is not to be recommended if you really are haunted by it in your dreams. It's just because it's all messed up and changed and rearranged. And
now, was that really your childhood home?
Yeah.
That's truthful.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And it really, you know, it's a place I pass by all the time. It happens to be when I visit my elderly mom, she lives. Our old home is exactly halfway in between my current home and her new home. And so I pass by it all the time. And I keep expecting to see the same wrecking ball that leveled the Winnipeg Arena, like working at this old dumpy place, and seeing my, I've had a few nightmares where I've seen my own bedroom being sort of exposed to light by a wrecking ball, and you know, like my toys and underwear spilling out on the second floor into a big heap of debris. And so I fully expect, just maybe even tomorrow when I go back home to Winnipeg, to see a parking lot there where my house once was.
I thought it was interesting, too, that early in the film, you playfully, I think, accuse Winnipeggers of being too stuck in the past. They're too nostalgic in a way. And then you very much show that you're a native son by doing that yourself, don't you?
I am indeed a Winnipegger, a sleepwalker. I just can sort of rewalk the same routes without even being awake. And because actually very little in Winnipeg has changed, I really don't have any right to complain that an arena or a department store, as beloved as they are, have been leveled when, in fact, most of Europe was leveled during World War II and all horrible things. But it was just a way of sort of exploring just what a perhaps pathologically troubled individual goes through when he thinks too much about his own past, that's all.
Did you learn anything interesting about Winnipeg that you didn't know before? Or I guess what would be the most interesting thing that you learned?
I learned lots of things about it. I swore I wouldn't do any research, but once word got out that I was making a documentary about Winnipeg, a lot of people who did know a lot of the First Nations folktales, the Native Canadian folktales, or some historical facts that I didn't know about, this IF Day where Winnipeg staged a massive Nazi occupation with 5,000 Nazi soldiers outfitted in costumes from rented from Hollywood, all to raise, to frighten Winnipeggers into buying war bonds. It seems like by far the most implausible anecdote in the movie, and yet it was actually what made Winnipeg most famous during the war. And many American and Canadian cities tried to hold their own IF days, and they never took off. I think it's because Winnipeggers are buy into. I don't know. They're more easily influenced by stories that appear from the outside. I guess because they're so isolated. Not just Hollywood movies, but even news stories seem like fairy tales to Winnipeggers. And I think they bought into IF Day more than anything else. So I learned about that while shooting. I learned, and it was a late addition. And actually, practically everything I learned about the tragedy at the horse racing park and all these really things that somehow all fit together like some kind of really snug jigsaw puzzle to make a kind of a psychic portrait of a populace. It's kind of neat. It's so specifically Winnipeg, this movie, that I'm actually hoping that it can be viewed universally somehow. I think people may be able to, with a little bit of wiggling, find their own hometowns in this movie.
Well, I know we did really enjoy the film. Best of luck here at the festival, and thank you so much for this conversation. It was fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. That was really fun.
Again, that was director Guy Madden discussing his new film, My Winnipeg. For bonus audio of our conversation, visit filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater and Maddie and I decide who will be the King of Kong. Stay with us.
Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You make a close, this whole place stinks with your farts for a week. How much you just ingested. Oh, what a big man you are. Hey, let me buy you a pack of gum. I'll show you how to chew it. Ooh, your pal closes. All that comes out of your mouth is bile. Ooh, how fucked up you are.
Who's my pal, Vicky? What are you? And what are you, Ricky, huh? Bishop Sheen?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we destroy a beloved screenplay and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, in Sam Van Hollgren's Film Spotting Swan Song, we massacred the scene you just heard from Glengarry Glen Ross, listeners getting one final time to delight in Sam's famous Al Pacino impression. I can't wait to hear yours. Sam has said you've got a pretty mean one, Maddie.
I'm more of a lemon as Machine Levine. But you know what? We should have Sam on again to do his Alec Baldwin impression in that film.
Really?
Yeah.
He can deliver there as well? All right. Well, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Brent Funderburk from Bloomington, Indiana.
Congratulations, Brent. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Oh, yeah. Makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, you know, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Okay, what about you, Chad? I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block is really going to open things up for me.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater and Maddie. It's a pretty obvious tie-in. We're in Toronto recording this show, and we wanted to find a Canadian connection. So that's really all you need to know.
They probably already know
They probably already know it, especially longtime listeners of the podcast may know where we're going with this one. But I've probably already said too much. I start this off, so you're going to give me the action.
And action.
You leave the people of this town alone. You can't help them.
You can help each other. Several people in the town have agreed to let me represent them in a negligence suit. Now, your case as an individual will be stronger if I'm allowed to represent you together as a group.
Case?
It's important that we initiate proceedings right away. Things get covered up. People lie. That's why we must begin our investigation quickly, before the evidence disappears. That's what I'm doing out here.
Listen, I know Risa and Wendell Walker. They wouldn't hire a lawyer. The Ottos, they wouldn't deal with you. We're not country bumpkins you can put a big city hustle on. And scene. All right. If you know what film from a Canadian filmmaker we just massacred, send us an email by Wednesday, September 19th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, just visit filmspotting.net.
The mysterious player from the West Coast, Steve Weeb, is here.
He could beat it if he'd have to have a really good game.
You want to put a score up. You're competing against everybody in the world.
It's not even about Donkey Kong anymore.
He's a very devious person. He works things out to his ends very well.
Well, Billy Mitchell always has a plan.
That's a clip from the trailer for the documentary The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. Maddie, we're going to take a few minutes to come down from the Great White North, come down from Toronto, and, well, maybe not come down. We're going to go to another world, the world of Twin Galaxies here, which is the authority that oversees the arcade game universe. Mm-hmm. And this film, The King of Kong, is a documentary about, essentially, it really is about two men who are competing for the title of The King of Kong, the champion, the all-time record holder of the great classic arcade game, Donkey Kong, forever been in the hands, as you heard there in the clip, of Billy Mitchell since like 1982. And then this new guy comes along, Steve Wiebe, who challenges it and beats it. But then there's all this conflict over that. The movie really is about these two men, even more, I think, than it's about Donkey Kong. Of course, it's about them. But this is a movie that critics have really been embracing. A lot of Film Spotting listeners who have seen it have written in and said, you got to check it out. I know Matt Singer, our friend from IFC News, wrote in when we did our top five movies of the year so far and said that it was his number three or two film of the year. He absolutely loved it. So it's kind of always been on our radar. We wanted to spend a few minutes on it because it still is playing in theaters. And I guess I want to know whether or not you think all the fuss that's been made over this film, critically, and as I said from some of our listeners, is justified.
Well, I'm going to say yes and tepidly no.
Okay.
Actually, you're right. This movie succeeds because it's not about Donkey Kong. And, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville, when he came to America, he's a Frenchman visiting America at the end of the 18th century.
Yes, I took American History 1 in college.
Exactly. He was amazed at Americans' propensity to associate. Because we live in such a large country, we form these little groups, these little societies. Mm-hmm. And that Americana still exists today. In fact, because of the internet, I think it's growing even stronger. You know, my parents, they show dogs. They're immersed in the dog show world. We talk about movies on the internet. Mm-hmm. We're certainly a part of that world. And within those little esoteric groups, I think human nature, all of human nature, the good, the bad, the ugly, are reflected. And I think that's the strength of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Mitchell, as the world champion record holder, is a terrific villain.
Oh,
he comes across as a terrific villain. And that's how the movie succeeds, the material. Unfortunately, as a documentary, I actually thought that more could have been done. I thought some different storytelling could have made this film even stronger.
Okay, well, what specifically were you lacking in the storytelling? What did you think could have made it a better film?
Well, unfortunately, to be a great documentary filmmaker, you basically have to strive to be a great umpire on a baseball diamond. You're going to succeed because we don't notice your hand at all in the outcome of the game. Unfortunately, I was very aware of these filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And when you introduce a character, especially Walter Day, who's this referee,
yeah.
the head of Twin Galaxies,
yes.
sort of the governing body of the video game scores, you see him, there's footage from 1982 as this vibrant middle-aged man. Today, he's emaciated. He's
yeah.
living in this Iowa farmhouse,
sure. yeah.
dilapidated. What's his story? Unfortunately, I don't think he got enough. I think Errol Morris, D.A. Pennybaker, if they meet a character like Walter Day, they're going to latch onto that
mm-hmm.
and really sort of illuminate his story even more.
Okay, well, I really do disagree with actually most of what you said.
Yeah.
Not the history stuff, but maybe everything else you said, I guess I disagree with. And we could really get off on a whole tangent about documentaries and whether or not they should be objective or subjective and whatnot. I actually tend to prefer documentaries where I see their hand at work, because the fact is the notion of objectivity, even in some of the great documentaries that purport to be objective, isn't really there. So I think what's interesting...
I'm not talking about hand at work in terms of trying to inject some kind of message or something
mm-hmm.
like that. I'm saying I thought it was sort of sloppily put together.
Okay, okay.
Especially the coda at the very end, I thought was sort of just sprung on there. It doesn't
yeah.
attach not very well.
Okay. Well, I do think that something I kind of liked about the film, and I have to admit, I guess I'm conflicted about it, because I do sort of agree with you that one of the things about the film that doesn't quite work is there were times where they very clearly have an agenda. They like Steve Wiebe. They like him
yes.
as a man. They do not like Billy Mitchell. They want Steve Wiebe to be the champion. They think he at least deserves a shot. We then, as an audience, I think we'd feel that naturally anyway, but we especially feel it because that's the way the filmmakers push us to feel. And again, I think we would naturally feel that way. There were times where they clearly vilified Billy Mitchell in a way that I didn't think they need to. And I'm talking about some specific shots that
mm-hmm.
just were heavy-handed
yes.
to try to make him the bad guy. Whereas if you just let Billy Mitchell be Billy Mitchell, he'll be the bad guy.
And so that was
an issue I had with the film.
Exactly. And I don't get me wrong. I did enjoy this film. All I'm saying is just I think there was just some shaggy filmmaking that was apparent to me.
Okay.
That detracted from it.
Well, I did like the film very much, I think, because I can get past any shaggy filmmaking here. I think Seth Gordon has done a really good job of making a movie that focuses on, as you said, this society and these individuals. And that's why I even think where I disagree with you about Walter Day, while he is an interesting character, I actually felt like maybe they should have left some of his stuff out, because it does open up too many questions about who he is. And the fact is, what they realized is, this world, this story, the essence of it is Billy Mitchell versus Steve Wiebe.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to focus on. And so I think they did a good job of being that umpire and saying, well, what is the real essence of this story? We could get into arcade gaming and we could get into what Twin Galaxies is and whatever else. But this is really Steve Wiebe and Billy Mitchell, and we're going to focus on that. So I think they did a good job there in that. And I've heard a lot of people make the connection to the Christopher Guest movies. It's funny that you mentioned
yeah.
dog shows and your parents, of course, Best in Show. But a lot of people, you watch this film at first, some people have a hard time believing it's real because these characters are so off the wall, so crazy, so kind of nerdy. And it is possible, because I heard people in the theater do this that I saw it in, laugh throughout the film. And I laughed a lot,
yeah.
but laughed throughout as if everything these characters say and do is funny. I maybe can relate to their obsessions too much to find them that funny. But the things they do and say, some of the things Billy Mitchell especially does and says within his obsession is pretty funny. And some of these characters, you can't help but you just can't believe some of the things that they do. I do think, and I don't want to get into this because we could really have a much longer discussion about this, but I have a theory about this film that I think there is something going on too, where I think Seth Gordon is actually trying to get at, in a way, I don't know if red state, blue state is the way to put it, but he is trying to make a point about America. And you essentially have in Billy Mitchell and Steve Wiebe the two kind of versions of the American dream and what we idealize as Americans. Billy Mitchell and his lapdog, Steve Sanders, who at one point makes a comment about Bush. We need a guy like Bush in the office. It's very clear that he is a pro-Bush guy. And Billy Mitchell is a winner. He succeeds mm-hmm. at everything he does. He's the guy who thinks that being American, and remember, his name is USA.
Yeah.
That's his name. And he wears American flag ties. He thinks he's the essential American. And essentially what Seth Gordon does as a filmmaker is he debunks that by giving us Steve Wiebe, who is actually, I think, for most Americans, most people watching the film, what we would think of as the all-around
yeah,
good American guy.
The terrific
guy.
Family man.
The family guy, and he's smart, and he's humble, and he's shy, and you feel for him, and you know everything about him, even playing baseball, you know, and he's been a failure. But then, you know what? When it comes time to put your chips in and go show up and challenge someone,
right.
he's the guy. So it's like, I think there really is something interesting going on, in a way, politically, that Seth Gordon is trying to say.
Yes, no, and I agree. And so, again, I hope people do go see this film. I think, yes, it reflects so much about where we are mm-hmm. as a society and about ourselves. You were saying people were laughing at these people.
Yeah.
Well, they need to look at themselves and realize that I'm sure they're involved in the same thing.
That's the thing.
They have to look at their own passions.
Yeah, no, and that's why I could relate to these guys. I don't play video games, but I could still relate to them. And there's actually a great point where I saw this movie with some film spotting listeners in Chicago, including our message board moderator, Alex Nesnick. He was in from Dallas, and I was talking to him before the movie, and he was asking me about my wife and how understanding she is about all the time I put into film spotting.
Right.
And I was saying something about how, yeah, you know, Sarah's great. We love spending time together, but she's not someone who needs me kind of around the house all the time. She just wants me to do my part and help out with the kids. She doesn't want to be left alone in that way, but she's not a needy wife or whatever I was explaining. You then, literally 10 minutes later, we go sit down in the King of Kong, and there's a shot where they're talking to Steve Wiebe's wife, and she goes, I don't need him sitting at home on the couch with me all the time, but when I'm trying to put three kids to bed and he's playing Donkey Kong in the garage, that's when I get frustrated. And it's like, that's my wife. Instead of playing Donkey Kong, though, I'm, you know, watching a movie or working on this show in some way. So there are a lot of ways into this film, I think, that we can all relate to, even though most people watching probably don't play video games and certainly aren't as obsessed as these people. But The King of Kong, I love this movie. I actually would say right now it would be one of my top five films of the year. That's how much I really enjoyed it and was moved by it. I mean, I've gotten emails from people who say they were cheering by the end of it, and I was one of those people who wanted to cheer as well. Well, at the same time, you can't help but be moved by Steve Wiebe's story as well. So I really liked it. You liked it too, obviously. We want people to go check it out.
Exactly.
And it is still in theaters out in select cities now.
Time for one last quick break. When we return, Adam and I will count down our top five films from the Great White North and the Toronto International Film Festival. Stay with us.
Hey, the street lights are burning up. Mom is something, yeah. Je monte un cheval. Qui porte des yeux.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
If I don't come back, you tell Mother I love her.
Your mother's dead.
Well, then I'll tell her myself. I got a loose cannon here.
You think this boy Moss has got any notion of the sorts dead are hunting him?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. That was a clip from the new Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men. We did a couple dispatches from the Toronto Film Festival where we talked about some of the films we were seeing and shared a few thoughts on those movies. The Coen Brothers movie, we're both Coen Brothers fans,
right,
and seeing their new movie was certainly one of our main objectives here. And listeners who heard those dispatches know where we're going to fall on that film, but there's a good chance you're going to see it pop up here.
Might make our
in
list.
Our top five, might just make our respective lists here in a minute. But we actually did want to start before we get to our top five. We wanted to get to last week's poll question because it does tie in nicely with the Toronto International Film Festival. We asked you if you could attend one film festival, which would it be? And the choices were Cannes or Cannes, depending on your perspective, New York, the New York Film Festival, Sundance, South by Southwest in Austin, Toronto, or Venice. Maddie, how did it come out? I'm not all that surprised, I guess.
Well, we are all going to the French Riviera. Cannes was number one. 43% of the people actually want to head there. Sundance was second at 25%. Mm-hmm. Toronto third at 18%. South by Southwest in Austin at 6%. Venice, only 6% of the people want to go to Venice?
I know.
Are you kidding me? And then New York, only 2%. That's fine.
Well, Maddie, where would you have voted? How would you have voted? This is actually your first film festival, Toronto. This is my first year here in Toronto, but I have been to Sundance and look forward to going back. I said on last week's show that the way I viewed it was my vote would be Cannes, because who doesn't want to go to the French Riviera, and it is the mecca kind of film festivals. But at the same time, I think Toronto's that one that I want to see myself going back to, because I think the films have been so good here.
Yeah.
That it's kind of the one maybe hardcore cinephiles look forward to, and Cannes is more of the kind of celebrity-fueled film festival. But how would you have voted?
Well, I think next year we actually need to bring the microphones and do the show from a gondola in Venice.
In Venice. Okay, yeah. Well, that's your vote. You are with the minority, only 6%. You're right, Venice was definitely tempting for me. Maybe we'll get a chance to go there. I actually have to say, some of the results from the Venice Film Festival this year were pretty shocking.
A little disappointing.
I mentioned this earlier in one of our dispatches earlier in the week, that actually Brian De Palma's Redacted, an Iraq war film, I saw here at the festival and didn't like it much at all. He won Best Director there. Ang Lee's Lust Caution, a film we both saw and are going to hold off on talking mm-hmm. about. We both saw it. Let's just say it's not going to be in our top five. So the fact that it won the top prize and the critics booed it there right. is kind of interesting at Venice. And also Brad Pitt actually won Best Actor for The Assassination of Jesse James. You didn't get a chance to see that film. I did. I strongly dislike Brad Pitt as an actor. He's actually pretty tolerable in The Assassination of Jesse James. But in that film, even, Casey Affleck gives a towering performance over Brad Pitt. The fact that he was overlooked is kind of disturbing, unfortunately.
How was Sam Rockwell?
Sam Rockwell's good, but he's kind of Sam Rockwell. He basically just gets to be kind of the comedic relief guy. He's a goofball. So I like to see Sam Rockwell be a little more serious. Right. You know, I mean, because he can stretch out. He's a good actor. He's a talented actor. So with that all said, let's get into our top five films. And we mentioned this at the top of the show here, that between us, we saw 40 films, 17 for you, 23 for me over a five-day period. And of those 40, about eight of them overlapped. So 32 or 33 unique films that we saw here at the festival. Though it is going to turn out, we're pretty sure, based on some of the conversations we've had, at least three of our top five here are probably going to overlap, because there really have been some standout films that we have seen. But we are going to have a couple of differences. Why don't you go ahead and get this started then? What was your number five film of Toronto?
Okay, my number five film is XXY, a film from Argentina and director Lucia Puenzo. Centers around the story of Alex, a 15-year-old kid raised as a girl, but there's certainly more to her situation. And I'm not really going to address that anymore, because I think the success of this film really hinges on its ability to question what defines gender mm-hmm. and sex. And it showcases the people around Alex and their inability to deal with her white elephant.
Okay. Interesting choice there. A movie I did not get a chance to see here at the festival, unfortunately, but an interesting pick. My number five is a film that I had some high expectations for because of who the director was. The director, Gus Van Sant, in the film is Paranoid Park. And unfortunately, this is a movie that, as of right now, doesn't have a release date that I can find for the U.S., but I'm sure it'll be in some theaters in select cities at some point. But Gus Van Sant's latest film, Paranoid Park, it's set in Portland. It involves skateboarding. It has a lot of these signature Gus Van Sant elements in it, just in terms of the storyline. Certainly deals with high school kids, sort of alienated high school kids, just as we saw in a movie like Elephant. But it's really interesting. If you read the press notes for this film, and it's really fantastic. Here's the synopsis. They usually give you, you know, full-page synopses mm-hmm. with these films. Here it is for Paranoid Park. Alex, a teenage skateboarder, accidentally kills a security guard in the vicinity of Paranoid Park, Portland's tough skate park. He decides, blank. I'm not going to tell you what blank is. They tell you in the press notes what he decides. That's the whole synopsis, though, is those two sentences. That's all they're giving you. But the fact that they are giving you that tells you that what he does or doesn't do isn't really important. I'm going to wait and let you see and decide for yourself. But they actually don't think it's that important, obviously. And the fact that it's only two sentences tells you as well that the movie is plot-wise not that heavy, but it really is just about exploring a little bit of this Portland culture and these kids who are looking for an escape. And what I loved about it is you take movies like Elephant and Last Days that Van Zandt's done recently, where he's really experimented and really tormented some audiences with the still camera. Here he got Christopher Doyle, Wong Kar-wai's great cinematographer, and he still uses these long takes and he still uses these still shots, but he also mixes in some motion, and the Super 8 shots of the skateboarders are really great to watch. And the most interesting thing, the last comment I'll make, is that he cast this through MySpace, which he actually thinks is the way to do it now. He wants to do that. Anytime you're looking for non-professional actors, he's going to just go through MySpace. And the guy who plays Alex, the main character, Gabe Nevins, is really good. I mean, Gus Van Sant knows how to use non-actors. And if you watch the film, none of them jump out at you as being non-actors, because he puts them in situations where they don't have to really act or emote. And unfortunately, what's really interesting, ironically, the one person in this movie who is an actual actor or actress, Taylor Momsen, she was Cindy Lou Who in the Grinch movie and now has grown up a little bit, she's the one weak link in the film. And it turns out, you know, I was sure she must be a non-professional. No, she's the professional, and she's the one weekly in it. So I don't know what that says, but Paranoid Park, Gus Van Zandt's my number five.
Well, good choice. Looking forward to that one when and if it comes out. My number four, a bit of a surprise, it's Michael Clayton, the George Clooney film. He plays a fixer for a law firm. And it's basically pretty much solid studio fare as a thriller. But the reason I'm including it on my list at number four is that it gave me my goosebump moment
really?
For the festival. I have to say, there is this confrontation at the end between George Clooney and Tilda Swinton, who is terrific as a fixer herself for this large agribusiness conglomerate. And the audience, we know what's coming. We know what's coming, and yet we couldn't help.
And it delivers.
Yeah, we couldn't help to stand up and cheer.
Okay.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, Michael Clayton is one of those big studio releases. October 5th, I believe it's coming out.
Right.
And one I didn't get a chance to see here, but one I do look forward to. My number four is My Winnipeg, the movie we heard a lot about earlier in the show, of course, with our interview with the director, Guy Madden, the Canadian director, Guy Madden. It's another movie that, unfortunately, we're not sure how you're going to see it in theaters or when. There is no release date set. But I love how, during our conversation with him, he said how he didn't realize how funny the movie was. And he caught himself having to actually hold back from playing to the crowd a little bit. The thing is, again, you get in kind of this insulated filmmaking world. You start to get bored by your own movie and don't realize that it's really funny. And the screening I saw, people were laughing all the time. I was laughing all the time. It's really, really funny. And I think what's brilliant about this movie, again, it's this docu-fantasia, the newspaper called it. That's, you know, again, a pretty good description. It's pretty out there. It's an experimental kind of documentary. But the way he manages to use this conceit of he actually gets his mom and actors to play his brothers and sisters, and he incorporates footage that he shoots in his childhood home where they reenact moments, you know, and we heard him talk about this, but reenacting moments of his childhood and getting to see Winnipeg through his eyes, but at the same time actually learning something about Winnipeg like right. you would expect a documentary to give you, when you can have the personal and at the same time this larger, you know, the kind of macro level as well, and actually learn something about Winnipeg, that's a pretty amazing feat. I mean, we've talked about on the show a lot of times about documentaries that really just are like every other documentary
right.
we've ever seen. We've even seen a couple of them here at the festival. This is like a documentary I've never seen before. Maybe the closest thing would be an Alain Resnais film like Hiroshima, Mon Amour, which isn't a documentary, but it has the same sleepwalking kind of daydream feel of this movie. So this really is a fascinating film, and I know we both really look forward to diving into Guy Madden's work a little more deeply now.
Exactly. All right, well, my number three, a suitcase full of money, endless desolate Texas plains, a psychotic Javier Bardem, the Coen brothers really get back to their element, and No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
Really don't want to go into it, because when this opens, I believe November 9th,
yeah.
we'll really have a great conversation about it, but this film is terrific.
Yeah, we're going to leave it there for now. We will end up hearing about it here in a few more minutes, a couple more comments. But my number three film for me is Juno, a movie that premiered here. And this is a movie from Jason Reitman, who did Thank You for Smoking, this libertarian kind of satire with Aaron Eckhart. And I actually really liked that movie. That was his debut. I thought it was pretty good. But Juno is more stripped down, more indie. It's less glossy, certainly, and low budget, but a step forward in terms of a filmmaker. And
hugely.
The screenwriter, Diablo Cody, first film, which is mind-blowing because the screenplay is good in so many ways, but this is a movie about Ellen Page, basically, as a high school student who gets pregnant from her boyfriend. She has sex once, gets pregnant, and decides to keep the baby. And that's really just what it's about. It's kind of, you see, it's told in four seasons,
right.
you know, with her getting pregnant and then through the time of having to deliver the baby. Michael Cera's in it. Jason Bateman's in it. I read on Roger Ebert's blog, he mentioned that when he saw it at a public screening, he's never heard a standing ovation and applause go longer at a Toronto film. I saw it with about 500 critics and industry people, and it was the loudest. It was really the only film that got unanimous applause when I saw it, and laughs throughout. Hilariously funny. In that same vein as sort of take Superbad and Knocked Up, but mix it with Ghost World and a little bit of Wes Anderson. But that's unfair to even say that, because it really is its own thing. And Ellen Page, really one of the best performances, one of the best comedic performances, certainly, but I think just in general, one of the best performances of the year in this film, Juno. And it's a movie that actually is scheduled to come out December 14th in limited release.
Yeah, well, great pick. It might be appearing here a little bit later.
Just maybe.
Just perhaps.
Okay.
All right, my number two is My Winnipeg. Just a wonderful love song, a love poem.
An ode to Winnipeg.
It is. It's absolutely hilarious. I can't believe he didn't think it was going to be
fun. I know.
Because he gets the timing so right on all those jokes. It's just so endearing.
Yeah, it really is. Endearing is a perfect word for it. Well, my number two is the movie Atonement. This is the adaptation of Ian McEwan's Pulitzer Prize-winning book from 2002. Joe Wright, the director of Pride and Prejudice, that was his first movie, reteaming with Keira Knightley from that movie. But here, she's better as an actress. He's better as a director. And Matthew McFadden, who I didn't like in Pride and Prejudice, replaced essentially in the male lead role by James McAvoy, who I think is an incredibly talented actor. Really loved his performance in The Last King of Scotland. But again, the key here is better acting, but Joe Wright, as a filmmaker, has taken another filmmaker who's taken a huge leap from their first film, and every shot in this movie, Atonement, has a purpose. The story is really quiet and subdued, but intense at the same time, never goes for sentimentality. And the story, just briefly, is about a girl, a young girl, who sees an event happen between her sister, Keira Knightley, and the guy who's kind of the stable boy, essentially, James McAvoy, that she completely misinterprets, and she makes a decision to do something that ends up hurting a lot of people's lives. And so the movie Atonement obviously is kind of trying to atone for that. I will say, as a filmmaker, not only is every shot great here, but there's one in particular where there is at least 5 minute single shot, tracking shot in this movie at the beaches of Dunkirk, a war movie shot that is one of the best shots. I mean, take any war movie you've ever seen with some great shots in it. This one is right up there with them. It's really bravura filmmaking. It's fantastic. I was blown away by Atonement. It's my number two.
When does that open?
It opens December 7th in limited release, so look for it in December.
Good, yeah. I didn't get a chance to see it. Well, my number one is Juno. I loved, loved, loved this film. Not only is it the funniest, it's also one of the smartest this year. And, you know, you mentioned that it's sort of a little bit like Rushmore and Ghost World combined. But what I love about this film, because it starts off a little quirky.
Yes.
And where you get I got a little bit nervous.
Me too.
But then it throws that away, you know, and just becomes this terrific story about this girl dealing with real life situations in a way that aren't presented on screen anymore.
No.
It was just terrific. You know, I was telling you, Jason Reitman, I think, learned something from his dad, Ivan Reitman, who worked, of course, with Bill Murray and John Belushi. Surround yourself with really talented people. And to a performance here, J.K. Simmons, Allison Janney, Justin
As
Bateman, Jennifer Gardner. Yeah, everybody in this film hits everything.
The cast really is perfect. There's so much more we could say about it. I mean, even Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman, their characters so easily could have been caricatures and been jokes. The parents could have been jokes.
Yes, exactly.
And the
it
representation,
refuses to do that.
It does. It does. It really is smart. It gives us a new view of teenagers. It gives us a new view of parents that we haven't seen a lot of times in cinema. And it really is a fantastic, funny film. So, Juno, you're number one, my number three. It easily could have been my number one or two.
Yeah.
These top three here are all kind of blending together. But my number one, you had it on your list, is your number three. It is No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film. Dark, violent. It makes the violence in Fargo look quaint by comparison, but also incredibly funny. And how you can make, in a single moment, someone terrifying and hilarious at that same time is quite a feat. And Javier Bardem, as the actor in the particular scene I'm thinking of, pulls that off. But the Coen brothers, in their writing and directing, managed to pull that off as well. Also, their main guy, Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, the shooting of this film is ridiculous. He also shot The Assassination of Jesse James, which is really good. So No Country for Old Men, we will have more to say about it in November when it comes out. That was my number one. So some overlap there. Definitely the movies to check out. No Country for Old Men, one to have on your radar. Juno and My Winnipeg were the three we had overlap. Those are three to kind of keep in mind and try to seek out if you get a chance to see them. So that is our top five movies from the Toronto Film Festival. Tell us which of the films you're most excited about, or send any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call, 206-203-2463, and leave a voice message. New in theaters this weekend, Maddie, The Brave One. The Neil Jordan film.
Avoid at all
you
costs.
Saw it here at the festival. Dragon Wars and Mr. Woodcock. This is that Billy Bob Thornton movie that has been delayed and delayed and delayed,
really?
Which is never a good sign. Also in limited release, three Toronto movies, two of which we saw, Across the Universe, In the Valley of Ayla, and Eastern Promises. They're all out in limited release. We reviewed Eastern Promises in the first segment of the show, of course. I say rush out to see the new David Cronenberg movie. Maddie thinks I'm crazy.
As usual.
Okay. Well, next week we will review Across the Universe, and we're planning to review as well Sean Penn's Into the Wild.
All right. Well, thanks to Alex and Angela in our message boards, Frank Huckle, Candace Grippis, and Jeff Houston. Thanks also to Arcade Fire and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Ballgame.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.